COVID-19 cases are plateauing in the Lone Star State, but wait, that's not the end of the story. More next on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
How Texas A&M is strategically positioned to mass produce a COVID vaccine. Switching gears now, how racism also occurs within communities of color. Disaster declarations after Hannah and what the governor is doing to restore the valley. Now, what story does your face mask tell about you? And neighbors trying to remain neighborly, how the U.S. and Mexico share the waters of the Rio Grande River. All that and more. Don't go anywhere. It's the Texas Standard. The more we learn about the coronavirus, the more we change the way we do things. It's Tuesday, July 28th. You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. We now know COVID-19 is a pulmonary disease that also affects the heart and other organs, and it's one of the reasons the state of Texas is now counting deaths differently. The new method increased the COVID death toll by 12% to 5,700 lives lost as of Monday. Joining us now is Dr. Peter Hotez. He is the Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. He's also the co-director of Texas's Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development. Dr. Hotez, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about the decrease in coronavirus cases. Are we seeing a decrease? Are we seeing a plateau in the state of Texas?
To me, what it looks like is more or less a plateau, meaning that the cases are not really going down very much, but they're not going up either. So It's good that they're not going up so much. The bad news is that they're plateaued at a very high rate. You know, they're plateaued at 100 miles an hour still, and so a lot of COVID-19 transmission. And the hospitalizations here in the Texas Medical Center seem down a bit now, but there's still a lot of community transmission, and the deaths are mounting also. So I'm still very concerned. And now we have this new sort of dire situation in South Texas that I'm very troubled about. You know, this right now, COVID-19 is probably the single leading cause of death on a daily basis in the state of Texas, just like it was in New York back in March and April.
Dr. Hotez, is it too soon to say why we are plateauing, to attribute it to anything?
We don't know. I think a few things are happening. I think people are getting the public health messages and wearing masks and practicing social distancing. They're, in many cases, they're kind of figuring it out on their own, watching the news. There have been, you know, the governor now is certainly encouraging masks, as are many of the county executives and mayors. So I think that's having a big effect. I guess the big question right now, and I don't have the answer to this either way, is whether these measures alone will be sufficient to start bringing the number of cases down, you know, putting it in a downward trajectory, or will it simply maintain the status quo? And I think that's a big unknown.
Now, the last time that we saw cases sort of plateauing, sort of trending down, you know, everybody got excited and we all went out, or I shouldn't say we all went out, but there was a lot of relief and going back to normal. What do you advise this time around?
Well, I think we have to recognize there's still an enormous amount of transmission going on. I'm really worried about the low-income communities, especially the essential workers who either have to, you know, be on construction sites or in family-owned businesses. I think they're getting hit very hard. I think we're seeing historic decimation of Hispanic communities in many cases, especially in South Texas, from Victoria down to the border. And that's one of the reasons I'm speaking out. I don't want to look at this 2 months from now and realize I could have done more. We, you know, are not doing well in Texas. We did well in March and April. I think we probably opened prematurely, and we didn't have all the right controls in place in terms of contact tracing and everything else. And this is not unique to Texas. It was true of all of the states in the South, from Florida all the way to California. You know, and I have been pointing the finger at the federal government that they did not provide the directives and guidance that were needed and just kind of left it to the states to figure out. And the states were never in a position to know how to manage all the epidemiology, and they needed the political cover of the federal government in these very volatile political times. And so this is why we're now in the situation where 20% of the global pandemic in terms of new cases is occurring in their southern states.
Doctor, you said you used some words that were very powerful. You said we are seeing the historic decimation of Hispanic communities. What are the challenges that are presented to you when you speak out about this?
Well, you know, one, we don't have all the data, right? And so, it's based on limited data, trends, reading between the lines, things like the, when you get the death count every day from the Houston Health Department, and you see the list of people who've perished on that day from COVID-19, and they don't list the names, but they list age and race and ethnicity, and every day it's Hispanic, 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 Black, Black, Hispanic, Hispanic, Hispanic. And that's repeated across the metro areas of Texas. Then you see what's going on in South Texas and bits of data trying to piece it together to create that kind of narrative. It tells me that something truly terrible is going on.
Our hope continues to be in a vaccine. Where are we with that?
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to figure this out well before a vaccine comes along. We're not going to have vaccines available to the middle of next year. And my point is we've got to take strategies now to figure this out. And we have to get around this notion we're just going to stand around and wait for the vaccines.
We've been speaking with Dr. Peter Jotes. He is the dean for the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, and he's also co-director of Texas's Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development. Dr. Jotes, thank you so much for carving a few minutes and speaking with us.
Oh, thanks so much, and thanks to you and Texas Standard for giving attention to this important issue.
We appreciate you, doctor.
Thank you.
Dr. Jotes is also one of the scientists developing a COVID vaccine. Many more are currently in the works. Yesterday, President Donald Trump visited a North Carolina facility that is testing another potential vaccine by a company called Novavax. The president praised the work being done to develop several possible vaccines across the U.S., but said if the Novavax vaccines prove successful, the manufacturing of that drug will be done here in the Lone Star State. Texas A&M University System Center for Innovation in Advanced Development and Manufacturing could begin producing millions of doses as soon as the beginning of next year. For more on that, we're joined by John Sharp. He's the chancellor of the Texas A&M University System. Chancellor Sharp, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
I am sure that this is exactly the kind of work that the Institute was developed for. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the history of the Center for Innovation.
Yeah, it was started in there was a competition across the United States in 2011. We entered that competition, and there were three facilities awarded. We were the only one within a university system. And basically, the purpose of this competition was to develop a place to manufacture vaccines during a pandemic. Everybody knew a pandemic would come, and voila, here it is. And so, so that's what the purpose of this center was.
And do you do work for the federal government?
What happened is we built a system. We sold the system or contracted the system to Fujifilm. We got all of the money back that the state had invested plus some, and we keep the authority, and BARDA, the federal agency in charge of this, keeps the authority with us to commandeer, if you will, the system anytime we want for national emergencies, especially pandemics. And so this particular vaccine is in phase two clinical trials, and once it gets permission from the federal government, it goes here. What's happening in North Carolina, and the reason the president was in North Carolina, is that's where the clinical trial is taking place. And so they have a smaller facility there that's producing enough vaccine to simply do the clinical trial, but doesn't have the capability to do mass production as ours was designed for. And so once the clinical trial is finished, once it's approved, it is then sent to Texas A&M here for the mass production of hundreds of millions of doses of vaccine.
I was going to say, I mean, it's one thing to talk about mass production, is another thing to talk about mass production. Have you ever done something at this scale?
No, we haven't had a pandemic since it was built. It was built because of the pandemics that were occurring in 2011. I think there was SARS and some swine flu and things like that. And the second President Bush decided we need to have facilities onshore instead of offshore to develop these vaccines, which was a great decision. So this is the first full-scale pandemic since the facility was built. This is what it was designed for, to produce vaccines in mass quantities.
Now, if Novavax is not successful or does not prove to be successful, do you not produce a vaccine, or do you go with somebody else's vaccine?
We do what BARDA tells us to do.
I see.
In other words, if the federal government decides that Novavax vaccine doesn't get past trial three, for instance, they can pick another candidate and do that. What they have done is put up a contract to reserve this facility for this production. They can change that contract and give us a task order completely different 24 hours from now for another vaccine candidate, which there's certainly others out there.
John Sharp is the chancellor of the Texas A&M University System, and we were happy to speak to him today. Chancellor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our social media editor is Wells Dunbar, and he's here monitoring the talk of Texas in social media. Wells, how are you?
I'm good, Joy. I'm good. You know, as we heard earlier in the program, since Texas changed to a more accurate count of coronavirus fatalities, nearly half of the reported deaths are Hispanic residents. Some truly stunning
that
numbers there.
That has me shaken, like, yeah. Really.
Yes, those terms we heard from Dr. Peter Hotez earlier in the program, calling it just an unprecedented, basically, attack on the Hispanic community. Hearing from lots of folks about this, Dallas Hall notes that this really can't be repeated too often in Texas. You're more danger of contracting COVID-19 right now than you were back in April or May. Conversely, so many people have sort of let their guards down since then. Mm. And Emily Haygood has an interesting point. Some of the misinformation out there that's revolved around these coronavirus deaths. We should state that the Texas Department of Health Services says that these are entirely accurate, more accurate numbers than before. Just one story we're watching, Joy. I'll be back with more later in the show.
Yes, it's a tough conversation, but keep it going. You're on Texas Standard Time.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town. Tours with social distancing at Moody Mansion, Bryan Museum, and Bishop's Palace. More at galveston.com. It's Island Time with safety in mind.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. Houston and other cities across the country are coming to grips with the racism within their own communities. In Southwest Houston, a Vietnamese-American businessman received death threats and a boycott when he put up a bilingual Black Lives Matter billboard. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval reports the backlash has shed light on anti-Black racism in the Vietnamese-American community.
Like millions of other people, Nguyen Le watched the 8-minute and 46-second phone video where George Floyd was killed by Minneapolis police. The 50-year-old businessman says he had to do something.
I need to speak up. I want to speak up.
Le remembered an ad from 1978 where Black civil rights leaders advocated for Vietnamese refugees like himself.
And then I realized, holy crap. Later that year, I was an 8-year-old boy languishing in a refugee camp.
Last month, Le put up a bright yellow billboard in Houston's Viet Town that read, Black Lives Matter.
And we added the Vietnamese translation, Ngi Thi Chung Tao.
Le says he was expecting some pushback, but the death threats took him off guard. This is a Vietnamese blogger on YouTube calling for Nguyen Le to be lynched for his billboard. The video has more than 36,000 views. His Facebook page filled up with hate speech. He was called a communist, and he says his insurance business lost 12 clients. The Vietnamese media criticized Le. He responded with a press statement.
I was never told that I am worthless by those with different skin colors. I know that my life would have been a lot harder to build if I did.
The billboard broke the silence on racism in the Vietnamese American community. Shortly after the backlash, people organized to support Le. They rallied in front of the billboard. They defended him on social media. And an online fundraiser for Le's business has been shared more than 3,000 times.
But I'm really encouraged by how many people have donated.
An Nguyen is a doctor in Houston and created the GoFundMe page. She says the billboard controversy has sparked difficult conversations in their community, particularly among young people and their parents who are more likely to be conservative. Take Bao Hung Huang. She's 35 and works in Cancer Research Administration. She recently sat down for dinner with her parents, where they normally steer clear of controversial topics. Then her mom spoke up.
And she said, you know, about that billboard, I've been hearing in the Vietnamese radio, they've been talking about it. And she said, initially, it made me very uncomfortable.
Her mom told her about the media reports showing people of all different races supporting the Black Lives Matter billboard.
She said, like, she just saw all these different faces, like masked faces, but faces, you know, out at the protest. She said she's had a change of heart. She said she thinks it's now a good thing.
Those who are older or first generation tend to be more conservative when it comes to racial justice issues than our younger people.
That's Janelle Wong. She studies Asian American public opinion at the University of Maryland. She's seen a small but vocal minority emerge in the community who oppose racial justice. But nearly 75% of Asian American voters she's polled say the U.S. government should do more to give Blacks equal rights with whites.
That group is still more progressive than white Americans as a whole in terms of their ideas about race.
Nguyen Le says even in his own family, the billboard led to debates, but also evolving opinions over what's meant by Black Lives Matter. I'm Elizabeth Trovall in Houston.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Governor Greg Abbott will be headed to parts of South Texas today to survey storm damage from Hurricane Hannah and also to meet with local officials in that part of the state. Portions of the Rio Grande Valley have been hit by two fronts. There's the serious flooding they experienced over the weekend, and it's also an area that has been hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. Michael Rodriguez is deputy editor of the McAllen Monitor. He and his team have been covering the storm and the aftermath of the storm, and he joins us now. Michael, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Joy.
Can you talk to me a little bit about which parts of the valley saw the most damage?
Sure. So speaking for residents of the Rio Grande Valley, they become accustomed to saying, where to begin? Because there was quite a bit of damage over the weekend. For example, there were at least a couple hundred thousand people without power as of Saturday. And yesterday, that number was down to, I believe, 57,000 people. Flooding, there were several feet of flooding in several areas. Also, there was a lot of structural damage. The roofs were torn right off. There were trees that had fallen on top of their homes. And it also created inaccessibility issues for first responders, emergency personnel to reach their destinations.
Michael, one of the things that I thought was interesting when you started this conversation is when you said, where do you begin? And one of the things that I find fascinating about the valley is how some areas are highly developed, and then some of the areas just down the road are suffering from a lot of structural neglect, such as streets that are not paved, such as not having running water. How challenging is it when you have these dichotomies in the same communities and you have a flood?
Those have been historically challenging issues in the Valley. Like you mentioned, for instance, we have some of the most wealthy individuals who live in the Valley, but Hidalgo County, for instance, is one of the poorest communities, one of the poorest counties in the state.
And the country.
And the country, yes. And there are 32% of the population in Hidalgo County, for example, have no health insurance. 30% live in poverty. And drainage issues have long been a problem in the Valley, specifically in the Mid-Valley, areas like Weslaco, Mercedes, and Progreso. So when these floodings occur in 2015, 2018, and 2019, and now we have Hurricane Hanna that just dumped another foot of rain on the region that's already saturated, then that just exacerbates the problem.
And can you paint me a picture of the balancing act between a natural disaster and a global pandemic all colliding in this area?
Yeah, so there were concerns, obviously, about power. There are individuals who are on life-saving oxygen at home, but who obviously cannot be hospitalized to have COVID-19 simply because the hospitals are overwhelmed with patients. And we did hear of one story, I did actually, of one individual who wanted to be admitted to a hospital. They had a cough. It started with a cough. And this individual was told that if you go to a hospital, you may have a very long wait in the ambulance outside the hospital. Essentially, the individual was given the choice of potentially dying in the ambulance or dying in their home.
Right.
They chose to go home and they died. And there were instances in which the storm, local officials feared, were going to complicate that. Now, we did hear some good news. There were hospitals, just McAllen Medical Center, that did not suffer greatly from the storm. We just reported today in our newspaper. But it also creates problems for first responders and emergency personnel who needed to perform high water rescues. And obviously, being in close contact with individuals who were stranded, they need to be lifted, carried into safety, and all while trying to obviously practice COVID-19 prevention efforts.
We've been speaking with Michael Rodriguez. He's deputy editor of the McAllen Monitor. Michael, thank you so much for your reporting and for joining us.
Thank you again, Joy.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texas voters will have more time to cast a ballot for the November general election due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Governor Greg Abbott is extending the early voting period by 6 days. It will now last from October 13th to October 30th. Later today, Governor Abbott will survey damage Hurricane Hanna caused in the Texas Coastal Bend and the Rio Grande Valley. Ahead of the visit, he told KRGV-TV, one of his top concerns is the spread of the coronavirus in the storm's aftermath.
And so we're very concerned about protecting the lives and health and safety of people in the Rio Grande Valley. And to help aid that, we are surging additional testing supplies. We are surging additional hospital and hospital personnel capacity to help address the medical needs of people in the Rio Grande Valley who may be facing challenges because of COVID-19.
Abbott is meeting with officials in Corpus Christi and Weslaco. Another central Texas county is considering relocating a Confederate monument amid ongoing nationwide protests for racial justice. Caldwell County commissioners are expected to vote today on whether to take down a stone obelisk outside the courthouse in Lockhart. During public comment, John Christensen said it should not be removed.
The memory and reputation of the Confederate soldier, as well as the motives of his suffering and sacrifice, are being consciously distorted by some in an attempt to alter history. If we don't resist those efforts, a unique part of our nation's cultural heritage will cease to exist.
Neighboring Bastrop County on Monday approved relocating two Confederate markers. The Austin Police Department on Monday released video recordings of the fatal shooting of Michael Ramos, a black and Hispanic man an officer killed in April. The officer, Christopher Taylor, shot Ramos as he drove out of a parking lot. Police had shown up after someone called 911 claiming a man had a gun. Body and dash cam video show Ramos get out of the car, put his hands up, and lift his shirt, following police orders. When officers tell Ramos to walk toward them, he doesn't. He yells he doesn't have a gun. He tells police not to shoot and that they're scaring him. Attorney Scott Hendler represents Ramos's family. He says officers escalated the situation
by barking commands and threats at a obviously confused and potentially under the influence Michael Ramos.
APD argues Ramos was using his car as a weapon. At the end of the video, Ramos can be seen driving away from police when Officer Taylor fires three shots, killing him. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the online UT High School, offering a full-time diploma program and a variety of individual courses, including for advanced placement. Learn more about options for the new school year at highschool.utexas.edu.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. The U.S. shares the waters of the Rio Grande River with Mexico. It's a give-and-take situation, and we do it in five-year cycles. But this cycle, Mexico has yet to complete its delivery. That's why Jane Harkins, the commissioner of the International Boundary and Water Commission, wrote a letter this month urging Mexico to rush its delivery. It is a huge amount of water. 533.3 million cubic feet. And if we change that to gallons, just to give you an idea, it would be billions of gallons. Joining us now is Sally Spiner. She is U.S. Secretary of the International Boundary and Water Commission for the United States and Mexico. Secretary Spiner, why is Mexico at risk of not fulfilling its five-year obligation?
Well, the concern is that we are in the last 3 months of the five-year cycle, and they still have a lot of water to deliver in a very short period of time. Really, it's not appropriate to wait. Mexico needs to be more proactive and start taking action right now. The concern is that we're just going to run out of time to be able to meet the delivery requirements.
And in a way, it is because it's happened before, right, where the five-year cycle comes to an end. And Mexico does pay, but it pays after the five-year period has ended.
That's what happened in the last five-year cycle, which was the October 2010 to October 2015 five-year cycle. Mexico did end with a debt, and they did repay that debt early in 2016. The difficulty is that you may not end two consecutive five-year cycles with a debt. That's not the way the international agreements work, so Mexico does need to end the current cycle without a debt.
And I'm glad that you bring up that it's an international agreement, because for people who don't know, it's an old agreement, almost 80 years old, from 1944. I wonder if it's time to renegotiate this agreement. Are there conversations in that direction?
No, there aren't.
I was in Mexico a year ago. That's when I talked to Commissioner Harkins. And I also asked the president of Mexico this question, is it time to renegotiate? And he seemed to be inclined in that direction. But you're saying that that is not a conversation that is happening.
That's correct. That's not a conversation that's happening.
Now, what happens next?
It's difficult to speculate on what might happen. But typically, if you have difficulties on any water delivery issue that our commission is involved with, we would engage both at the technical level as well as the diplomatic level to try to resolve the matter.
Secretary Spiner, how does Mexico deliver the water? I think for many of us, it's hard to understand when we're talking about large quantities of water. How does that happen?
In accordance with the 1944 Water Treaty, the United States is entitled to a portion of the water arriving in the Rio Grande from six Mexican tributaries. So these are rivers that are just flowing into the Rio Grande from Mexico. The water actually flows into two international reservoirs on the Rio Grande. The challenge that we have right now is that some of that water is in Mexican reservoirs in Mexico and is not flowing into the Rio Grande. And so what the International Boundary and Water Commission, United States section, has done is to urge Mexico to take immediate action to increase the releases from those Mexican dams so that we can have the water flowing into the Rio Grande and Mexico can meet its treaty obligations.
Secretary, as I was telling you, I've reported on both sides of the border about this, and I feel like every person I talk to gets the idea that they should get more water than the water than they're getting. Why is that?
I think it's the nature of the region where we live. It is an arid region. There's population growth. There is agriculture that's very important to the economies of both the United States and Mexico. And particularly in the Rio Grande Basin, there's a high level of variability. I think that's part of the reason why the water delivery obligation is a five-year obligation rather than an annual one, because it recognizes that you can have a really dry year and then you can have a hurricane. One of the things that we've been doing through the International Boundary and Water Commission in cooperation with other partners is trying to do some technical analysis and modeling that would help us develop some different water management strategies that would provide greater predictability and reliability in those water deliveries for both the United States and Mexico. And we think that in the future that would help avoid some of the concern that we're seeing right now.
Sally Spiner is U.S. Secretary with the International Boundary and Water Commission for the United States and Mexico. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
You're welcome.
In our series Drop by Drop, we explore more water stories that tie Texas and Mexico together. Check it out at texasstandard.org/dropbydrop.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
I'm Paige Avery. I'm from and currently live in Olympia, Washington, but I am a student at Texas A&M University, and so I go to school there during the school year. Everything got canceled probably mid-March, and then I think by the end of March is when people were, at least half of the people were starting to wear masks. Given the fact that my mom also started making them pretty early, so I had some, or I would say I had more than the average person at that point in time, especially in terms of like not single-use ones. She was making pleated ones, and then she started making fitted ones, and then she got super into the curation of the fabrics and the different trimmings and whatnot. And so then, of course, the Texas A&M masks. Yeah, I have a lot of A&M masks. The fabric she got is really loud, I guess you could say, the A&M fabric, and so I like it when she does like a maroon floral on the front with then the trim of the A&M, because it's a slight nod to the spirit, but it isn't so overwhelming. It makes me a little self-conscious. I was walking through the Dallas airport with one of the masks with the super loud print all over the front. And I don't know, I just worry, you know, about what people think of a person wearing such a strong statement about their college on their mask, you know. I mean, yeah, I guess the mask is the new way to show your allegiances. The tour guide masks that we get for campus tours are branded, and they've ordered like a bunch of different kinds of them as well. So when I was indoors, we had to wear the mask, but when we were outside giving the tours, we didn't have to. But indoors, it does get kind of hard to breathe because you do have to kind of take in like really quick and deep breaths before you do a big loud spiel. And I was really surprised actually at the struggle that I was kind of having with that. I mean, once I don't think I have to wear it for coronavirus purposes, I'm sure I'll still keep a couple on hand. But who knows what'll happen to the rest of them. I mean, there's going to be such a surplus of everything that's been created. One thing that I think will happen is that people will keep wearing masks when they're sick now, which is something we didn't really do before here in this country, but other countries did. So I think that this might kind of change the way that people protect themselves when they're sick with any kind of illness in the future. So I think that's a good thing. I'm Paige Avery. You're listening to the Texas Standard.
We're just kicking off our Tell Me About Your Mask segment, and we want to hear from you. The goal is to record just a slice of history when old Texans were required to wear face coverings. So reach out to us on social media or send us an email at texasstandard@kut.org. Rick Britell was a former director of the Dallas Museum of Art and the founding director of the O'Donnell Institute of Art History at UT Dallas. But those titles really don't convey his outsized influence in North Texas art. Britell died Friday. He was 71. KERA's Jerome Weeks shares with us some of his many accomplishments.
Rick Britell had battled prostate cancer for years, but Michael Thomas says it's characteristic that not even cancer slowed down his projects, including meetings about a new art museum at UTD. Thomas is the current director of the O'Donnell Institute.
The last one of those meetings was Monday, and Rick was on his way to the hospital where he was informed that he was going to need to go into hospice. But he sent me a text and he said, "We've got so much to do in so little time," and that was Rick.
As an art scholar, Britell contributed to more than 24 books, 3 just on Camille Pissarro, 2 on Claude Monet. But he wasn't simply an academic or administrator. The richest arts prize in Texas is named for him, the $150,000 Richard Britell Award in the Arts. In 1988, when he was hired to lead the DMA, Britell wasn't even 40 years old. He'd previously been the curator of European paintings at the Art Institute of Chicago. Carolyn Britell says Chicago is where her husband discovered a central talent of his. He pitched an idea for an exhibition and was told, "You raise the money, you can stage it."
And so Rick went right out and raised the money. And I think that's where his fundraising skills really came out, and he just kept building on that.
Something else Britell realized there. Much of the Art Institute's renowned collection came from Chicago's leading families.
Dallas is a much younger city, and he thought, well, if I can have a hand in helping people to collect major works of art and form local collections, one day that might benefit the DMA.
Britell was soon consulted by North Texas' richest arts patrons. He even taught a course on the art of collecting. In person and as a teacher, Britell was enthusiastic. He had a vivid way of conveying his learning without being pompous. This is from a lecture he recorded for the well-known Great Courses series. He's explaining a landscape by Monet. It shows the painter's revolutionary brushwork, his colors, and his politics.
You actually follow Monet's hands. You see how he applies paint to the surface, and that was considered crude if your paintings were not smooth like glass. So this is very aggressively art related to human sight, and it's art related to democracy.
By 1992, Britell had raised $55 million for a major new expansion at the DMA. But that year, he was arrested for public lewdness by an undercover police officer. It was part of a sting targeting homosexual activity in Dallas parks. Britell pleaded no contest to the misdemeanor charges, and he resigned from the DMA. His career as a rising star in the art world seemed over.
That was a painful period, but, you know, Rick had this inner strength to just say, well, that's happened to me, but I've just got to go on.
Willard Spiegelman believes resigning from the many duties of managing the DMA actually liberated Britell. Spiegelman is a former SMU professor and a friend of Britell's.
When that happened, he was able, through his own grit, imagination, good luck, and affability, he was able to translate that into a career of an unprecedented sort.
Britell was a museum builder. The DMA expansion was just his start. He was wooed into teaching at UTD in 2000. By 2013, he became the founding director of the O'Donnell Institute there. Recently, he's brought to UTD the Crow Collection of Asian Art, the Barrett Collection of Swiss Art, a collection of Latin folk art, and a renowned art library. These will be all gathered into his last museum, his Athenaeum. It's an old term for a place of learning. When the Athenaeum opens in 5 years or so, it'll mean UTD has become a serious center for art and art scholarship. Michael Thomas, the O'Donnell director, says Bertel wasn't just talking about such future plans before he died. On July 17th, a friend pushed him in a wheelchair through the Kimball Museum's current show of Italian masters, Flesh and Blood.
Of all the things to typify Rick, the fact that a week before he died, he was going to see an exhibit that he knew he couldn't miss. I love that story.
In Dallas, I'm Jerome Weeks.
Because of COVID, Rick Bertel's memorial celebration will happen at a later date. It's 49 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. This week, we're looking at rapid removal of migrants from the United States at the border, prompted by a Centers for Disease Control order. Since March, the federal government performed 70,000 expulsions using this order. Texas Public Radio's Reynaldo Leaños Jr. starts us from Laredo, where he spent time with Border Patrol agents to see how exactly things are being carried out on the ground.
The COVID-19 pandemic hasn't stopped activity in Rafael Garza's sector. I met up with the Border Patrol Special Operations Supervisor along the Rio Grande one recent morning.
Okay, right now we're in downtown Laredo, pretty much near the both international bridges, Bridge 1, Bridge 2.
And there's a road to our left and a grassy area to the right, leading down to the river. On the other side, the Mexican city of Nuevo Laredo.
What Laredo is, it's very cartel controlled. So the cartels see this as a business. So basically nobody crosses the river without payment to them.
COVID-19 hasn't changed that, but it has changed how Border Patrol does its job.
The implementation of Title 42 has helped out to mitigate the spread of the coronavirus into the United States, because all these people that are coming across that we do apprehend is, we don't know their past travel history, where they're coming from, if they're symptomatic or asymptomatic.
Title 42, which Garza mentioned, is part of the U.S. code that deals with public health. The Trump administration cites Title 42 in the CDC order from March and says that's what allows officials to quickly return migrants who cross the border, even asylum seekers and children, who are supposed to go through a formal legal process, as Cardinal Brown puts it.
What's happening now is that with the CDC order under COVID, they are saying that public health law basically is superseding immigration law.
Cardinal Brown's the director of immigration and cross-border policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. She says the Trump administration's use of Title 42 is unprecedented. Title 42 has been around in some form since the 1890s, originally enacted to stop boats from entering U.S. ports if they came from areas dealing with spikes in infectious diseases, like smallpox or cholera.
But as far as I know, this is the first time it's been used very broadly to apply strictly to people entering between the ports of entry at the U.S.-Mexico land border.
A CBP spokesperson told me, quote, "By quickly expelling individuals who cross illegally, we protect them, our agents, and the American public from potential exposure to COVID-19." But migrant advocates and some policy experts like Cardinal Brown say this is just the latest way the Trump administration is deterring or preventing people from having full access to the asylum process in the U.S.
So they're not even bothering with any of the immigration law requirements, and they're just simply sending people back to where they came from.
The ACLU and others say what's happening is illegal and filed a lawsuit. The medical community has pushed back too. Dr. Catherine Peeler with Physicians for Human Rights say the group asked six experts in infectious disease to review and analyze the CDC order, their conclusion?
There really was no public health sense behind it. So it really kind of categorically targets one particular group.
In May, Physicians for Human Rights told the CDC asylum seekers are no more likely to spread COVID-19 than students, temporary workers, and truck drivers who cross the border and are currently exempt from these types of restrictions. During our interview in Laredo, I asked Border Patrol agent Garza about this.
And I think that question is more political. It's a matter of personal opinion, whether it's six experts or six Border Patrol agents. I mean, who are you gonna trust? But right now, if you see it is working, it is a good tool that the United States government is using to mitigate the spread.
CBP data shows since the CDC order went into effect in March, there have been almost 70,000 Title 42 expulsions at the southern border. Most individuals or families returned to Mexico aren't from there and have no idea what to do next. They can end up homeless or targets for organized crime. Just a few reasons groups like PHR and Amnesty International call these expulsions inhumane and human rights violations. These groups say the federal government can both protect the public health in the U.S. and migrants seeking protection. Sarah Melendez is a public affairs officer. She joined Agent Garza and me on the Rio Grande that day. Melendez jumped in to answer a question I had asked Garza about some of the claims made by these human rights organizations.
Any of those questions dealing with human rights or ACLU or anything, you can put those in email writing and we'll have our headquarters office give you a response back to that. Go ahead and submit it in writing and we'll get you a response back because we have to look into it. We got to see what they're talking about and we got to do some more research on it. Okay?
We reached out to CBP, and by email, a spokesperson didn't directly answer the question either, and reiterated that Title 42 has helped mitigate the spread of COVID-19. I'm Rinaldo Leaños Jr. in Laredo.
The story was produced as part of a larger series. You can learn more at texasstandard.org. And you're listening to the Texas Standard. That tells me that Wells Dunbar is in the house. He's the social media editor. How are you, Wells? What are you hearing? What are you reading?
Oh, joy, where to start? Well, let me tell you. Okay. Some days you wake up, you log on to Twitter, and immediately decide you'd be better off
going back
to sleep. Yes, this, I'm sorry to report, joy, is one of those days.
Yes. I'm bracing myself, actually.
Okay. The term demon sperm is trending on Twitter, yes, after President Trump shared a video featuring...
I think you need to explain.
Well, he shared a video featuring a Houston doctor with some, shall we say, unique medical perspectives. Mm. Here's how we got here. The president shared this video of Houston Dr. Stella Emanuel claiming that the discredited COVID-19 treatment, hydroxychloroquine, works and, quote, you don't need a mask. Well, news website The Daily Beast did a little digging and noted that Dr. Emanuel has some other unorthodox views. They write, and I quote, she has often claimed that gynecological problems like cysts and endometriosis are in fact caused by people having sex in their dreams with demons and witches. She also...
I almost feel like we shouldn't continue.
Well, it gets a little more PG rated here.
Okay.
She also alleges that alien DNA is currently used in medical treatments and that the government is run in part not by humans, but by reptilians and other aliens.
Okay.
So all these takes are gleaned from sermons Emanuel delivered and posted to YouTube. Here, we should note that she's also a preacher and operates a church out of the same West Houston strip mall where her
medical
practice
is quiet,
located.
Completely quiet about
that. Quiet, yeah. No one has anything to say about this
whatsoever.
One, about the president retweeting a video from this woman. Of course, social media exploding. Just one comment we received via Twitter from Johnny D. He says, it's funny until friends start reposting these videos, thinking she is enlightening the world. And I guess a postscript to all this, fascinating. We've seen this time and time before. It's happened again. This video that President Trump has shared has since been taken down. A video some media shared by the leader of the United States removed from Twitter for violating the Twitter rules, they wrote. These rules against misinformation. So obviously not the alien stuff, not the fun demonic stuff, but instead these are claims.
Yeah, the
video highlighted that hydroxychloroquine works, that you don't need a mask,
et cetera, et cetera. Masks.
Exactly.
Period. And hydroxychloroquine has been discredited by reputable doctors.
Yeah, studies coming out, essentially, I think, showing that it has done more harm than good in several cases.
Well, believe it or not, this show does not make itself. The team includes men and women, many of them native Texans, working hard for you and on behalf of everyone on this show and on David Brown. I thank you for joining us today, and let's do it again tomorrow. How about that? I'm Joy Diaz.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.